do a reading. Hi, I'm Sherry. I'm going to do a reading. This is from an interview with Julia Butterfly Hill. It was in The Sun in April of 2012. It's definitely been a long time. So the interviewer asked, so if we want to change the world, we have to begin in our own lives. And Julia Butterfly Hill says, that's right. One of the best things about unsustainability is that it's unsustainable. At some point, it has to collapse. If we make changes in our own way of living, we can be ready to step in. That's the silver lining. The grief comes when we see who and what is being destroyed in that collapse. It is those hundreds of species a day that are lost. It is poor communities. It is people who live on tiny islands that are submerged by rising sea levels. But at the same time, there is hope that, because the old system is collapsing, we'll have a chance to build something better. If we are strategic about it, we'll look at that collapse as compost, and we'll begin to build the beautiful garden we want. As the old system decays, it will become food for what we are growing. CSA farmer in Colorado. I was 31 and I was in the midst of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I knew it wasn't working in an office. I'd never heard of CSA before, but I realized it was exactly what I wanted to do because it encompassed the three criteria that I just then discovered were essential to me. One, it involved being physical and working outside. I'm not a good sitter downer. It was educational, and I had previously been an elementary school teacher, and it was for something. I had been involved with a number of campaigns that were against things, such as drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I used to live in Alaska, and against wars and against genetic engineering. But I love the idea of getting to grow good organic food and be for something. So CSA, if some of you don't know, it stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And the idea is, like, you have a mechanic you trust, you have a dentist you trust, but in this model you have a farmer you trust. And it's like joining a gym. You join a gym, you pay your annual membership fee, and you get certain benefits. In the CSA model, you join a farm, and you get a box or basket of produce, whatever they have each week, and the farmer gets that reliable financial support. Every farm or ranch across the country, there must be over 3,000 or 4,000 now of these types of farms in the country. Everyone is a little bit different depending on the farmer and the season and where you are. But all involve a commitment of some kind between the grower and the eater who will enjoy what the grower grows. We ran our CSA for 18 years. Providing a wide assortment of vegetables, herbs, some fruit, and some flowers to up to, at our peak, 200 households in the Portland area. Over the last 10 years, we have also grown our restaurant accounts, and we've been more and more focusing on selling to local restaurants and some wholesale accounts and a couple of aggregator type of CSA, actually CSAs that buy from other farms. So, and now we're even transitioning more, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. We have or will never use pesticides or any kind of synthetic fertilizers. I always say it's just against my religion. We love our little piece of land, and we would never do, we want to do everything we can to care for it by building our soil, by providing ample habitat for birds and beneficial insects and bees, and rotating our crops and using drip irrigation and natural amendments using loads of compost. So that's our quick little how we do our farm. When I originally did this talk, my husband and I did it together, and he's a big part of it, so I'm gonna sort of speak with his voice right now. And he would say, he graduated with a degree in music in 1986 and eventually found himself touring with the Glenn Miller Orchestra. For 3 years, he toured around the country and in Japan playing swing music all over. And as much as he loved music, he had started longing to do something that was hands-on and tangible, because when he was growing up, his father, who was a Southern Baptist minister and an avid gardener, often told stories of his life growing up on the farm in South Carolina. And those stories always stuck with Brian, even as he rode buses and planes with the band. And in between shows, he found himself looking for information about farming and caring for the earth. And he remembers talking about going into an Earth Day office in Japan when it was the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. Fast forward 5 or 6 years, and even though he was fully involved with music and then renovating our first Northeast Portland home, my interest in farming really resonated with him. And so we started looking for our own farm. We lived in Northeast Portland in the, what's the name of the neighborhood? In the Piedmont neighborhood, and I was commuting to a farm that we were leasing in Hillsboro for 5 years. I commuted. So by 2002, we decided we wanted to try to look for our own farm. And thanks to a lot of hard work, sweat equity, and creative financing, totally, we were able to buy our little piece of land that would eventually become our little 10-acre Dancing Roots farm. So we're in Corbett, just off exit 18. As a musician and a teacher, my husband, Brian, had always dreamed of making some sort of difference with his music in the lives of his students. And as he got older, he started to feel that putting all this energy into music felt like fiddling while Rome burns, you know that phrase. And he was like, I am not going to be the next John Coltrane, and even if John Coltrane were still alive, would anyone even get off their couch to go here? That's how he was feeling that way. And at the same time, he saw my focus and the way people were turning onto sustainable agriculture and the whole good food movement. And he also realized farmers were disappearing, we all eat, the land needs to be stewarded, and it kind of all made sense to him too, and it had the satisfying air of reconnecting to his heritage. So instead of spending hours practicing obscure old jazz tunes, dissecting complex chord structures, and refining my instrumental technique, as Brian would say, I was practicing the art of cultivation, dissecting the soil structure, and refining our farm systems. And it just felt right to be putting more of his time into something that he felt was really, truly fundamental. Now, we still argue, and I continue to tell him that music is really important. So he's, I guess, maybe lucky that he gets to do both things. But so as we bought our farm and as we worked on it, he actually became my farm partner. And not just my supportive husband, but my actual farm partner working together. And I would always refer to him as infrastructure man and always envision this white Tyvek suit. But instead of an S for Superman, it said I for infrastructure, because he does all the buildings and the tractor work. And tractor work, building fences, the electric, the plumbing, the irrigation, all that stuff. So this new home was our second major fixer, and our new 1916 farmhouse. We had to get that livable, and so then we're now on a somewhat livable home on tillable land, and that was just the beginning, just to get that second house done. It's still not finished, by the way. Even after 20 years of full-time farming now, and been doing that, we both have a hard time expressing all the reasons why do we do this very hard work. And, you know, more often people will come and say, oh, how's the farm? And we just, you know, there's just this floodgate that we want to answer with. Like, do we say it's the most complex and overwhelming thing we've ever done? Or if we had a decent amount of dollar for every hour we worked, we would be absolute millionaires by now. And then if we want to try to really talk about why we do this, people's eyes glaze over. And so now that I'm right here on the pulpit and you're all a captive audience, I'm going to tell you why we do this. So here's a couple of reasons why we do this work. We want to make a living, of course. We both feel that people who toil to provide the basics of our world should make a good living. Unfortunately, that's not the way in our capitalistic system, as you all know. The closer you are to the actual growing of the food or the extracting of the resources, the harder it is to survive monetarily. And we always wonder, why is it that so many other occupations provide good salaries and good benefits while growing food so people can eat is such a notoriously low-paying endeavor? And in the modern world, I think probably everybody knows it, and if you don't know, if you want to grow cannabis, you can make way big bucks, but you can't eat it. Why is it in this country, at least in our system? We really like being part of and contributing to the local food and the local good food movement. We both love stories of famous people in science and the arts or politics that were part of the larger creative community that supported and pushed each other to achieve. And we have a really great group of fellow sustainable farmers that we get together with once a year in Brighton Bush in the winter. And there's many other opportunities for us to get together with other farmers, and it just feels great to have that supportive community, and we know what we're talking about, the different challenges that we all face. However, it doesn't happen all that often because we don't have a lot of leisure time. And then we both really like doing something real and tangible. Brian especially is not drawn to things, neither am I, to things that are virtual or digital. We always have appreciated more the living, breathing, tangible, analog elements of our world. And we both too feel that the more our whole society becomes enamored with the virtual world, it seems like the less we interact with and therefore care about the real world that truly sustains us. So we wonder what will happen one day when we don't have a power grid and the internet's down. And what, you know, let alone how do you make things and how do you grow things, how do you eat? So being involved with this is a very grounding, satisfying feeling. And then most of all, both of us, we just want to help make people aware that their eating habits really are tremendously important and influence our world in many ways. So Wendell Berry, who there's a million quotes from, Wendell Berry was an author and a farmer and an activist in the East Coast, said, eating is an agricultural act. We're participating in agriculture every time we eat. I want to emphasize that. Every time we eat, we are participating in agriculture. When you eat food, any food, wherever it's from, you're supporting some type of agriculture. It's just impossible to avoid. If you buy food from the industrial food machine, that's what you're supporting. If you're eating food that you grew, or a neighbor grew, or your farmer grew, then that's who you're directly supporting. And in these two different models, the industrial model or the farmer or yourself, who do you think has the community and the planet's health in mind? And no matter what you're concerned with in this modern world, and there's so many things to be concerned about, local economy, civil rights, indigenous rights, workers' rights, healthcare, pollution, all of these things actually are affected by our food choices because it's so pervasive in our world. It really does bother Brian and I. We say it pains us to see that there are many people who care about the world, who care about injustices, who give time, who give money to good causes and good charitable organizations, but not necessarily thinking about it, are willingly giving their food dollars to businesses that care more about the bottom line than the health of their customers and the planet. And we really believe that many answers to the problems of the world can be could be on your plate every single day, three times a day, every day, three times a day on your plate. And so there's this thought that, or there's this one side that says, well, if you're concerned about the source and the quality of your food, then you're elite. You know, there's that Portlandia episode of these people. I actually haven't really watched it, but I know there's this one scene where this couple was in search of trying to find the source of their free-range chicken or something like that. Okay. So I was really kind of mocking this view that if you care about your food, that means you're elite and snooty. And yet cheap, processed, unhealthy food that actually makes some people sick makes a few people fabulously wealthy. That's the elite. Okay? We really believe in the values of slow food, an international organization that has chapters all over the world and certainly all over our country. And the basic campaign of slow food is that all food should be good, clean, and fair. And both of us got to be delegates to a every other year convention in Italy where we met with peasant farmers all over the world, all in an effort to promote good, clean, and fair food. So then again, why do we want to do this very hard work for very little money? And I'm reminded when I first got started about 20 years ago, I had this conversation with my little brother who makes all his money. And I was telling him, it was my second year of farming, or third, right near the beginning. And I said, Tori, I made $12,000 this year. And I was really proud of myself. And he goes, $12,000? That's less than I pay in taxes. And I said, yeah, but I get to work outside. I don't have to go to a gym, and we get to work with our hands. And then we had this long list of things. I said, yeah, but I get to do this and this, and I finished with, and we eat really well. And he said, yeah, I guess I can't say the same about any of those. He just sells stuff, you know. But I want to articulate some of the reasons why we do this. So we get to eat really well. That's a big one. We know exactly how our food is grown. We get to work with our hands and be physical. We get to know we're reducing our community's carbon footprint. Food isn't coming from however many thousands of miles the average food travels. We're part of a community of caring activist farmers. We get to be very keyed in with the progression of the seasons. We get to be outside in the beautiful scenery, get to be out on a beautiful farm. Although I will admit that the east wind where I live, I'm always looking for reasons why to love the wind. Still working on that. We have less disease problems because of the wind. That's one of the good ones. We get to be our own boss. We get to commute right out our back door. We get to see our apprentices and all of our workers learn, and sometimes they have gone on to become farmers. We get to see our plans and our systems come together and work out sometimes. We get to see our customers, which we often like to think of as our co-producers. They make the connection between what they eat and how they eat and their health. And one of our CSA members a number of years ago had a hip replacement surgery. And at one point they'd been members for many years, and the couple was telling us the story that when the nurse came in to change out his bandage, she said to him, "Oh, you must eat really well." And he said, "I do, I eat a lot of vegetables from my farm." And she said, "Yeah, I can tell." It literally, he could see it in his body, how he was healing. And then we also get to be a platform for trying to be the change that we would like to see in the world. But you know, the joy of farming that we would say is not just for us, it's for us that have dirty hands, and I can never get the dirt out from under my fingernails as much as I try. It really can be experienced by all of us as conscientious consumers, or more accurately, active co-producers. And like I said, every time you eat, whether you're buying food at a store or a market or going out to eat, you're making a decision. I also want to say that growing food has deepened my understanding of the many issues involved with feeding ourselves in our modern world. And one that especially resonates with me has to do with seeds. Seeds provide the basis upon which our lives depend. And that, I want to repeat that. Literally, seeds provide the basis upon which our lives depend. Vandana Shiva pointed out, when so few transnational corporations control the seed market, it's not a free market anymore, it is a cartel. Dr. Shiva is an Indian scholar, environmental activist, author of more than 20 books, and she's received the Right Livelihood Award and the Sydney Peace Prize. If you haven't heard of her, she is a total mentor and model to me. Sadly, what we're facing right now is this fact that 10 transnational corporations control the entire world seed market, and the top three control almost 50%. And this was, might even be a little bit old news. It's the most recent that I found. So what we're talking about is the very source of all of our food on the globe. We actually should all be shocked and motivated to change the situation. It's pretty grim. And you might not be surprised to hear this, but not even considering genetic engineering, the multinationals are breeding for really important things like precise uniformity in ripening and a certain shape. Thank goodness the square tomato was rejected. They're breeding for things that, like, they can only thrive with significant quantities of synthetic fertilizers, or the ability to be shipped long distances, or the ability to be harvested by ginormous machines. You get the picture. This is what modern breeding is focusing on. I'm guessing there are some exceptions, but they are generally not breeding for nutritional content or flavor. And I won't give these corporations one penny of my seed budget and one penny of my food budget if I could ever help it. So where do we get our seeds? We buy all of our seeds from seed companies at the other end of the spectrum, the mostly small seed companies, many who grow or breed their own seeds, and several of whom are breeding for organic growing conditions right here in the Pacific Northwest. And all of the seed companies that we buy from have signed the Safe Seed Pledge. It's right in their catalogs, meaning they do not knowingly buy or sell genetically engineered seeds or plants. And just bragging in a little way, when I talk about what if we get together with the farmers in the winter, we've actually kind of become friends with some of these seed growers, and I feel like this is an amazing thing that I get to hang out with seed breeders, because they're real heroes. When we buy our seeds directly from these seeds people and breeders, we're directly supporting the kind of agriculture we think is fundamental for the kind of future we want. We grow mostly, though not exclusively, open pollinated or heirloom seeds. So we do buy some hybrids. We're not purists, we buy a few. But mostly, 85 or 90% open pollinated or heirloom seeds, because we believe, as Frank Morton said, genetic self-reliance and adaptive responsiveness are important. Hybrids, useful as they are, do not deliver these. Again, genetic self-reliance and adaptive responsiveness. Those are things that our local seed breeders are breeding for. Frank Morton is a nationally respected seed breeder from Philomath. His seed company is called Wild Garden Seed, and their racks are around here. You can get seeds from them. You can get their catalog, they're online. He's actually a little bit of a rock star in our little geeky farming world. And he's got a cute little southern accent. Reading through his catalogs is a great educational adventure. And I would say we are joyfully rejecting the unsustainable industrial model when it comes to choosing what to grow. So not only are we growing our own, we're buying our seed from seed producers who we value and respect their choices. So again, it comes back to our individual everyday choices. Will we make food choices that support our health and the health of our soil and the health of the planet, or go with the cheap food and inadvertently choose to support the soil eroding industrial agricultural paradigm and literally continue to increase the profits of Monsanto, DuPont, and Cargill? I mean, you really get to make that decision every time you eat. Referring to the obvious connection between cheap food and the epidemic of food-related health problems, Greg Higgins, the owner of Higgins Restaurant in Portland, said, "Well, I figure I can pay the doctor or pay the farmer, and I'd rather pay the farmer." And we like that. Greg Higgins was one of the first in the Portland area to kind of spearhead the restaurants buying directly from local farmers. It didn't start here, but he was one of the first in Portland to start buying directly from farmers. So we farm, we buy our seeds thoughtfully, but we also go to the store to shop for what we don't grow or what we don't trade for. And we occasionally go out to eat. Not very often, and we can't really, just don't have the time. So just as we seek out locally made goods, or at least look for a Made in America sticker, we also endeavor to spend our limited dollars on as local and well-grown as possible. Which brings me to another point, which is that people might have an image of this picturesque, pastoral, simple life version of farming. That is not what we found. Modern day farming, which is also known as direct market farming or truck farming, it's kind of the old term, but it's still used, is multifaceted, it's broad, and it could be all consuming. And we can't just be farmers. We're business owners, crew leaders, educators, marketers, food coaches, accountants, food counselors, recipe providers, mechanics, fabricators, plumbers, and delivery drivers, and probably a few other things I've left out. In the fall of 1994, I was at one of my first farming conferences at Edgefield, and Wendell Berry was there. He was a keynote speaker, and he mentioned that then, in 94, he learned that the number of farmers in this country had dropped to less than 2% of the population. So at that point, we got grouped under other as a list of occupations. By one account, there are more people locked up in prisons in the US than there are farmers. Additionally, the average age of farmers in this country is 60. I think it's now up to 62. What do we think we're gonna do? How disconnected can we get from our local, from our food source? Will we order groceries and prepared meals online and have them shipped in from outer space? Will we have food replaced by vitamin-like pills or patches? So, you know, these are things that we wonder about. Someone's got to be farming. Someone's got to be growing our food. So against some of these odds, we can, my husband and I can, we intend to continue farming and living very frugally. And we've taken to heart Abraham Lincoln's vision when he said, the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small piece of land. And what I want to segue to is, I've also been, in the last 6.5 years, I got roped into being on the board of an organization called Friends of Family Farmers, because I found out that I realized that small farmers like me and the many, many other small farmers in Oregon, we had no voice in the legislature in Salem. And all of our senators and representatives would hear from on a regular basis was the Farm Bureau. And the Farm Bureau, we might have a few things in common with, but mostly we have very little in common with the Farm Bureau. They're a national group with chapters in every state and in every county. And the Farm Bureau is actually funded by Monsanto, and they represent corporate agriculture. We when we bought our farm and we have our farm insurance, I looked around briefly, didn't have a lot of time to do the real research, but I looked around and we ended up getting insurance through Country, I think it was called. But in order to get insurance through Country, you had to join the Farm Bureau. So even paying the $85 or $100 annual membership fee to be a member of the Farm Bureau, it was still cheaper, so that's who we went with at the time. And when I filled out my form, the form to join the Farm Bureau, you know, name, address, phone number, email address, the question was, what commodity do you grow? Not what food do you grow? So I checked other, and I wrote, I grow food. I was so bothered that, you know, it just commodity grower. And another little thing is in the Farm Bill, which is going to be coming up, again, it comes up every 5 years, it's a national legislation, the Farm Bill. What we grow, what all of us eat, that's called a specialty crop. And even Earl Blumenauer acknowledged that we need to change that term. We need to call it food. There's commodities and there's specialty crops, according to the USDA thing. So commodities are wheat, corn, soy, cotton. I think cattle might be a commodity. There's like 8 things that are commodities, and everything else they call a specialty crop. So that kind of sets the tone, like we gotta fix that. So when I learned about Friends and Family Farmers, I was like, okay, I'll be on the board. This is something I could really get behind. And we have a rally day every other year. We go to Juneau and bunch of us small farmers get out there and we say, family farms mean business. And, you know, listen, we exist. We bring money to the state. We employ people. And maybe as much as anything is we keep money circulated to the local economy. We buy our seed from local growers. We buy our feed, our fertilizer, our gas. We pay our local employees. We, all the small farmers, we really keep our money in the local economy. So I've been on the board for 6.5 years. And then this last year, in January, we found out that our executive director was going to be leaving. And before you know, I am the interim executive director while I'm farming. And so I was like, okay, I can do this on a very part-time, very interim, very temporary basis, because I was not looking for a job. I was a farmer. And so, but what happened is over the summer of working part-time, I had to go down to the office in Salem. I get to do some work from home. I really liked the even more what the organization does and what the potential to do good for small farmers was what really put wind in my sails. And I realized that this is what I want to do, and I've been farming for 20 years, and now I get to be in a position where I help other farmers with the same challenges that my husband and I have been struggling with for the last 20 years. So I put my thing into the board that I said, hey, I want to do this full time. So I'm now the new executive director of Friends of Family Farmers. So and again, like I said, what is so motivating to me is the ability to do good, to really move the needle forward so that legislators hear us. So we have one lobbyist, we have one representative in Salem on our behalf. The other side, industrial agriculture, has about 15. So we're gonna keep going. That's why I'm involved with this organization. I was telling Brian the other day, it's the only thing that I can imagine, like giving up full-time daily farming for is to be able to help lead this organization and move all of us forward. So, I didn't remember the time. Okay, good. So I'm just going to leave you with some action steps, and then hopefully we can have some good Q&A. If you want to start making a difference with your food dollars, here's the options that I would encourage all of you to consider. First and foremost, learn to eat what's in season. Right now, that's peppers, we have a lot of peppers, kale, winter squashes and fall squashes are coming on, and a whole bunch of others, and we can talk about that after. But learning to eat what's in season is really critical. The first best option would be to grow as much of your own food as you can. If you can't or don't want to, that's fine. Commit to buying directly from another local farmer or rancher, or through a CSA, or through farmers markets. Shop at farmers markets, farm stands. There's lots of co-ops and stores that buy from local farmers. Those are the next levels. Even at a supermarket or a big box, buy local and organic as possible. One of the reasons running a CSA got difficult is because when we first started 20 years ago, we had local seasonal organic produce, which was a niche at that time. There wasn't a lot of that. Now you go to any Fred Meyer, almost any Safeway, and you can get local seasonal organic produce. So that's good. So we're it's a high quality problem, really. Local scale or large scale organic is not quite as good as small local organic because they are monocropping, but organically, it's not as good as small local organic, but it's better than industrial conventionally grown for sure. And if you're eating out, please try to be sure to patronize restaurants that buy from local growers. It might be a little bit more expensive, just don't do it as often. And then finally, your congregation can consider a congregational policy on healthy food. And I know that the Interfaith Network for Earth Concerns has some sample congregational food policy samples that you guys could consider for your own food within the congregation. And I guess lastly, I would say to consider volunteering for Friends of Family Farmers if you're looking for an organization. Maybe you'll get sucked in like I did too. Doing the great work and moving the needle forward to having a more sustainable agricultural system that we all feel. Do I close with my reading now? Okay. I'm going to come back to Julia Butterfly Hill. She says, 7 billion of us and counting are all activists because we're all actively shaping our world. The only question is, are we conscious activists or unconscious activists? We see the results of unconscious activism all around us. Virtually every problem is caused by unconscious choices being made over and over and over again. It's impossible not to make a difference. Every choice we make leads either toward health or toward disease. There's no other direction. The question is not, how can I, one person, make a difference? The question is, what kind of difference do I want to make? Thank you. I invite you now into the spirit of meditation and prayer. Close your eyes if you wish. Place your feet on the floor. Make yourself comfortable and breathe. As you pause and reflect on the words, stories, and reflections we heard today, I invite you into the space we have made in our worship together to honor and reflect on both the great joys and great sorrows we all carry in our hearts today. Let us pause as we prepare to listen deeply to one another.